1978, a year clouded by its share of tragedy and sorrow.
One of the women from the People's Temple tried to leave. Her head got blown off.
Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
We just thought it was like a sonic boom, and we look up, and we see this plane, and the wing was on fire, and we just see like pieces of metal just kind of like floating away, and then we hear the crash, and then all this fire shot up.
And now the last procession begins to move back into the vast main gate of the Basilica. First,
1978, a year shining its ray of hope.
A framework for peace in the Middle East.
The signing of the framework for the comprehensive peace settlement has a significance far beyond the event.
Peace now celebrates a great victory for the nations of Egypt and Israel and for all mankind.
This is Recap 78, a review of the major events which shaped the 365 days, the 52 weeks of the year 1978. First, this message.
This is a message about living. It's for quite a lot of people who are dying. They're dying because they're not treating their high blood pressure seriously. If you're one of them, you should know that your high blood pressure is treating you very seriously. In fact, it's doing all it can to kill you. Sure, you may feel and look terrific, but that's the way your high blood pressure fools you. One day a victim feels fine. The next day, he has a stroke, or heart disease, or kidney failure, any of which can kill. Your high blood pressure is like a time bomb ticking inside you, ready to kill or cripple you at any moment. And as long as you let it go untreated, the bomb inside you keeps ticking away until it finally explodes. So if you think your high blood pressure isn't serious, you're not just kidding yourself. You're killing yourself. See a doctor. Get back on your treatment. Stick with it, and you'll live a longer, healthier life. Treat your high blood pressure and live. A public service message of this station and the Advertising Council.
1978 was James Earl Carter Jr.'s second full year in the White House. For a look at how Jimmy Carter fared, here's correspondent Roger Gittins.
For a while, it seemed like President Carter couldn't do anything right. His energy program, the cornerstone of the administration's domestic policy, was in shambles after a year of congressional squabbling. Leading Democrats were openly critical and in some cases downright scornful of the White House performance. Frank Moore, Mr. Carter's top lobbyist, was banished from the office of the Speaker of the House because Tip O'Neill was outraged when one of his cronies was fired at the General Services Administration after Moore had reportedly assured him it would never happen. Senator Edward Kennedy also locked horns with the Carter crowd, declaring political war on the administration's cautious health care proposals. Other allies found that Mr. Carter was unable or unwilling to keep his end of vote trades. HEW Secretary Califano became public enemy number one in tobacco country by launching a vigorous federal anti-smoking campaign. Striking farmers took over the Agriculture Department building briefly and blocked rush hour traffic to protest low prices. Little things stung, too. The president's chief of staff, Hamilton Jordan, got himself embarrassing publicity by allegedly spitting a drink on the blouse of a young woman at a Georgetown singles bar. Burt Lance wouldn't go away. And the Republican federal prosecutor for Philadelphia refused to be fired and accused the president with tampering with one of his investigations. Meanwhile, Mr. Carter's popularity in the public opinion polls dropped into the low 30s from a high of over 70 percentage points. White House morale began to sink as well. One prominent official conceded to friends his boss would be a one-term president if things didn't improve. And for a time, they didn't improve. Mr. Carter's drug abuse advisor was caught writing a phony prescription for powerful drugs. Peter Bourne quit quickly, but in the process implied that drug abuse, primarily pot smoking, was not unusual among the president's staff. The hubbub over the Bourne affair, however, obscured the first signs of the turning tide. Mr. Carter's position on Capitol Hill was improving. He won a showdown over the question of giving arms to Saudi Arabia. The energy bill was picking up momentum, though without most of the administration's original tax and conservation provisions. The biggest victory came with the Panama Canal treaties.
General Torrijos and the Panamanian people have been patient and forbearing during the negotiations and during the Senate debate. They've earned the confidence and respect of the American people. Their actions during the last few months is proof of their willingness to form a partnership with us. to join in cooperation rather than confrontation.
The president defied the odds by winning ratification for both PACs.
All Americans should share the pride I feel in the accomplishments which we registered today.
He succeeded in lifting the arms embargo against Turkey in spite of powerful congressional opposition. And Mr. Carter vetoed the defense authorization bill because it included money for Navy supercarriers, and he made it stick. The Camp David summit made the comeback official. Mr. Carter gambled that a face-to-face meeting between the Egyptian and Israeli leaders, refereed by the President of the United States, could break the long deadlock. This is Roger Gittins reporting.
It was early September when President Carter, President Anwar Sadat, and Prime Minister Menachem Begin climbed in helicopters and disappeared behind the chain-link fence of Camp David, the presidential retreat in Maryland. The time of decision had come after nearly a year of drifting and backpedaling after Sadat's historic visit to Jerusalem. As it was later described, the Camp David summit came close to breaking down at least once. Begin said that it began to resemble a marathon, with meetings that lasted until 3 a.m. and then starting again to prepare for the next session after only a few hours' sleep. The conclusion was a personal triumph for the American president. Begin said that the real name of the meeting should be the Jimmy Carter Summit, and the result was two documents. One, a set of guidelines for drawing up a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, and the other,
one of the agreements that President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin are signing tonight is entitled A Framework for Peace in the Middle East.
There was jubilation in the air that night as Mr. Carter announced the result on a worldwide radio and television broadcast.
There are still great difficulties that remain and many hard issues to be settled. The questions that have brought warfare and bitterness to the Middle East for the last 30 years will not be settled overnight. But we should all recognize the substantial achievements that have been made. One of the agreements that President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin are signing tonight is entitled A Framework for Peace in the Middle East.
The high hopes were echoed by President Sadat and then by Prime Minister Begin.
The signing of the framework for the comprehensive peace settlement has a significance far beyond the event. It signals the emergence of a new peace initiative with the American nation in the heart of the entire process.
Peace now celebrates a great victory for the nations of Egypt and Israel and for all mankind. Mr. President, we the Israelis thank you from the bottom of our hearts for all you have done for the sake of peace.
But as it turned out, it was not the beginning of the end of turmoil. It was merely the end of the beginning. The Egyptian-Israeli negotiations, which began on October 12th, seemed to make good progress in the early stages, but quickly bogged down when the negotiators sent the results back to their governments. The Israeli cabinet rejected the draft treaty, and then 1 month later accepted it. In the meantime, the Egyptians had raised a new issue, a firm link in the peace treaty with a timetable for the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which the Israelis then rejected. Once again, Middle East peace proved itself to be complicated and elusive. This is Jim Anderson reporting.
The most bizarre story of 1978 came from a place called Jonestown. A jungle cult exterminates itself after killing an inquiring congressman. This is Brian McFadden. A recap of this cult of death after this message.
What America Means to Me by Kathy Hartman.
Did you vote in the last presidential election?
Yes.
Are you going to vote in the next one?
I don't think so.
I really think our country is the best country in the whole world. And America has the best people in the whole world, too.
Did you vote in the last election, by the way?
No, I didn't.
Are you going to vote in the next one?
No, I'm not.
Why not?
Because I don't see nothing worth voting for, you know.
We have a president, and that is a lot better than a king and queen, because all the people can say who will be president.
Did you vote in the last election?
No, I didn't.
Are you going to vote in the next one?
I might.
And in America, anybody can grow up and be the president. Even a girl.
Did you vote in the last presidential election?
No.
Are you going to vote in the next one?
No.
I like our country more than anything in the world. I really mean it. That's all.
God bless America. Please?
From the Franciscans, with love.
California Congressman Leo Ryan had gone to Guyana to look into a cult called the People's Temple, an American group with strict religious and left-wing political inclinations, which had set up its headquarters in a place the group leader named after himself, Jonestown. On his way out of Guyana, a few of the cult members asked Ryan and his party to take them along. A decision to say yes meant death for Ryan and four others. Three news people and would-be defector Patricia Parks, all shot in an airfield ambush, apparently by followers of cult leader Jim Jones. NBC TV technician Steve Sung was one of those lucky enough to be only wounded.
They systematically shoot us. They don't just shoot everybody. One of the women from the People's Temple tried to leave. Her head got blown off. Don Harris, the congressman, Bob Brown, the cameraman, and the still photographer from Craig Robertson from Examiner. He got his head blown off. Basically, unfortunately, they blow the head off. Otherwise, can you imagine bleeding to death in the jungle?
Five other members of the Parks family also survived, including 18-year-old Brenda Parks.
While we was boarding the planes, they started shooting at us, and they killed my mother and saw a few other people. And after that was, after they quit, you know, we thought they were leaving. So about five of us got out and ran to the bush, and we was in there for 3 days.
But back in Jonestown, an even more incredible event was taking place, an event few would live to tell about. Odell Rhodes was one of those few.
Jones told the public there that these people wouldn't reach the States and that everyone there would commit suicide.
As the social scientist began studying Jonestown and all it represents, American helicopters removed the remains of more than 900 men, women, and children who followed a man named Jones to a would-be utopia in the steaming jungles of South America. The event brought this comment from the President of the United States.
I don't think that we ought to have an overreaction because of the Jonestown tragedy by injecting government into trying to control people's religious beliefs. And I believe that we also don't need to deplore on a nationwide basis the fact that the Jonestown cult, so-called, was typical of America, because it's not.
Just what the madness called Jonestown was really all about may never be known. This is Brian McFadden.
The stunning series of events within the Roman Catholic Church began innocuously enough on Saturday, August the 5th, with a brief announcement that Pope Paul VI was taking a few days' rest in bed because of arthritis in his knees. Then 24 hours later came a swift series of bulletins from the Vatican that he had suffered a heart attack, and 2 hours and 10 minutes later that he was dead. Thousands flocked to see Paul's body lying in state at the summer palace at Castel Gandolfo, and hundreds of thousands more crammed St. Peter's Square for his open-air funeral.
And now the last procession begins to move back into the vast main gate of the Basilica. First, several priests bearing crosses, and behind them, the first of the file of more than 100 cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church who jointly have celebrated this Requiem Mass for Pope Paul VI.
Then the cardinals were sealed up in the Vatican Palace to elect the new pope. Traditionally, black smoke from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel is the signal that the voting is inconclusive, and white smoke that a new pope has been elected. But when the chimney started pouring smoke on the Saturday evening, the setting sun shining through the smoke made it impossible to be sure what color it was, even for Vatican radio.
Well, for more than 9 minutes, the smoke has been belching out of the chimney, and everyone's trying to decipher for themselves, just as we are here watching from the television monitor. And the people in the square are doing the same. Everyone's pointing, they're discussing things with one another. Some say white, some say gray, some say black. But it seems to be black.
Senior Cardinal Deacon Pericle Felice put an end to the suspense with his announcement from the balcony that the cardinals had elected Venice Patriarch Albino Luciani to be Pope John Paul I. Although he was a theological conservative, the shy and smiling figure of John Paul I made an immediate popular impression with the crowds in the square, and his popularity was still growing 6 weeks later when on Friday, September the 29th, the Vatican stunned the world again by announcing that John Paul had been found dead in his bed, again apparently from a heart attack. Once more, the cardinals converged on Rome for a second conclave, and they set the scene for the biggest surprise of all. Cardinal Felice's announcement that this time they had elected as supreme pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church Polish Cardinal Karol Wojtyła,
the first non-Italian pope in 455 years. His election set off great outpourings of joy, both in his native Poland and among the large communities of Polish Americans in the United States, like Mrs. Jenny Wosek of North Royalton, Ohio, who came to Rome for his inauguration.
I think he's a people's pope, and he's very concerned about all the people. And he took the time and he took the energy to walk all the way up the aisle and all the way back down again and touch as many people as he possibly could. And this is the first pope that I've seen do that.
The new Polish pope quickly set about establishing his own style, journeying about Italy by helicopter and adding his voice to that of President Carter in defense of human rights. At the year's end, he was hinting broadly that he would return to Poland next May as the first pope ever to visit a communist country. Edwin Smith for Recap 78.
September 25th, a PSA jetliner collides over San Diego with a single-engine Cessna. 144 people die in the worst air tragedy in U.S. history. This is Bob Foss. I'll be back with a Recap 78 after this message.
What if you went off to college and found that you were different from everyone else, and everything was designed for them, not for you? Suppose you went to the library and all the books you needed were in Braille, and you were the only one who couldn't read. You'd feel left out, wouldn't you? And what if you went to class and found that there were no chairs because all the other students rolled in with their own wheelchairs? Suppose one of your professors gave his lectures talking with his hands, only his hands, and everyone understood sign language except you. You'd think it wasn't fair. Well, that's how handicapped people feel now when they go to college and find extra handicaps. But things are changing, and we have free information that can help. Write Closer Look, Box 1492, Washington, D.C., 20013. A public service message on behalf of the United States Office of Education.
PSA's Flight 182 from Sacramento to San Diego with a stop in Los Angeles was filled with business commuters on the morning of September 25th. Flight 182 never made it. It collided midair with a small Cessna, crashing into a block of San Diego homes, killing 144 people. An FAA controller named Steve Gibby wrote a letter to his superiors a year and a half before, warning that with the mixture of small and large planes around San Diego's Lindbergh Field, a collision was inevitable. His memo was filed away. But on the fateful morning, that's precisely what happened, and the result was America's worst air disaster. Transcripts of the air-to-ground communication indicate controllers in San Diego warned the pilot of the PSA 727 that a Cessna was nearby. The pilot responds to the last of the warnings, "Okay, we had it there a minute ago. Think he passed off to our right." But recorders inside the cockpit indicate the crew was busy looking for the Cessna. From the tapes, the first officer asks, "Are we clear of that Cessna?" The second officer responds, "Supposed to be." The pilot adds, "I guess." Adds an off-duty PSA pilot riding in the cockpit, "I hope." But from the ground, witnesses saw the planes come together. 14-year-old Michael Bagnus was at school.
We were sitting down, we're having a break between class, and we hear this boom, and someone says, "Look at that." And we just thought it was like a sonic boom, and we look up, and we see this plane, and the wing was on fire, and we just see like pieces of metal just kind of like floating away, and then the thing like took a turn and just start to go like almost a direct nosedive down, and then we hear the crash, and then all this fire shot up.
All 135 aboard were killed on impact, as were the pilot and instructor riding in the Cessna. Seven died on the ground. A block of homes was turned to an inferno. Albert Garcia was one of the first at the scene.
When I went there to try to assist the firemen, it was all in blaze, all our houses. I believe there's an apartment house back here. When I was walking through the debris, I saw parts of arms and legs. I saw a half of a torso. And it was just like I was in the Korean War, and believe me, this is worse, can I tell you. But what I saw was really terrible.
Garcia, like the others who saw that scene shortly afterwards, will never forget it. It took days to remove the bodies. A local Catholic school was turned to a temporary morgue. The crash rekindled a long-standing debate about the airport's location. San Diego Mayor Pete Wilson, who had been trying for years to move the airport away from downtown, was at the scene soon after the crash.
I thought that this was the wrong place then, and obviously if this had occurred somewhere else, You'd probably have the same loss of life in terms of the passengers on the aircraft, but you would have averted the loss of lives in the neighborhood.
The crash also brought calls for the Federal Aviation Administration to look into the crowding of the skies around major airports. With so many small planes and big jets flying together, controllers say there are near misses every day. Some say it was lucky there hadn't been mid-air collisions before. In San Diego, the luck ran out. This is Bob Frost for Recap 78.
Hubert Humphrey's old friend Isaac Stern rendered a musical tribute as the happy warrior lay in state on the black catafalque which had borne the remains of Lincoln and Kennedy. The powerful and once powerful of the nation gathered beneath the Capitol's great cast iron dome to pay final respects. Old friends and old enemies of Humphrey were there, from Gerald Ford and Richard Nixon to President Carter and Humphrey's protege, Vice President Walter Mondale.
He taught us how to live, and finally, he taught us how to die.
The ceremony was brief, simple, and moving. And in a grace note that would have delighted Humphrey, a moment that had been scheduled to be silent, for prayer or meditation, was filled at President Carter's request with a spontaneous rendering of America the Beautiful by the assembled dignitaries. This is Fire Chamberlain on Capitol Hill.
The union miners sang strike songs and left the coal in the ground. The stockpiles industry had in reserve plus non-union coal kept most power plants and factories alive. Yet layoffs climbed to more than 25,000. The mine owners ignored the slim chance of government seizure, as the 160,000 strikers ignored the threat of fines, and so the strike went on and on and on. President Carter brought the bargainers to the White House, announced one settlement that was not to be, and invoked the Taft-Hartley Act. For weeks, things looked better without getting better.
In the last 24 hours, I have detected progress.
President Arnold Miller's grip on the United Mine Workers loosened as his bargainers rebelled and angry dissidents demonstrated. It took a full 110 days until late March before the strikers finally agreed with the owners, winning benefits the White House had to say were too good. By year's end, the coal industry was still behind, mining less than the year before, a setback for the president's plan to switch much of the nation back to coal. This is Dennis Colino reporting.
The night of June 6th, all eyes were on California and 75-year-old Howard Jarvis, celebrating victory in a fight for lower taxes he waged for 15 years. Jarvis was the man behind Proposition 13, the initiative overwhelmingly approved by California voters, reducing and permanently limiting property taxes to 1% of value. Tax bills for California homeowners dropped by more than half, and Jarvis proclaimed the start of a taxpayer revolution.
We have proven that here in California that we, the people, not the politicians, are still the boss.
That message went far from California, where the state's large budget surplus was used to soften the blow on local governments. It was heard in Michigan and other states where tax cut measures were adopted by voters. And it was heard in Washington, where congressmen and senators jumped on the tax cut bandwagon. And even California Governor Jerry Brown, Jarvis's biggest opponent, became a tax-cutting ally, using the issue to sweep to re-election as governor. Bob Fuss reporting.
The Supreme Court waited almost until the very end of its term to deal with the hottest potato on its 1978 calendar, the Allen Bakke so-called reverse discrimination case. At issue was the right of a state university medical school to set aside a certain number of places, in this case 16 out of 100 in its freshman class, for members of minority groups considered to be the victims of earlier discrimination. Allen Bakke, a white engineer, contended that admission system kept him out of the University of California Medical School, while less qualified members of minority groups were accepted. A state court agreed, and so did five justices of the Supreme Court, up to a point. That point was an order for the admission of Bakke to the Davis Medical School and the invalidation of the school's special admissions program. But at the same time, a different combination of five justices also held that schools can use race as one factor in admissions programs, thus upholding the legality of many other so-called affirmative action employment and school admissions plans. This is Tom Foti.
July 1978, Richard Nixon makes his first post-Watergate speech in a small town in the Kentucky coal fields. This is Pye Chamberlain. A recap in a moment.
There's people around here that are getting hurt by this. Not only the people that worked at Youngstown Keaton, too. People that worked that had grocery stores, had small taverns. Their business is dead right now. This doesn't only hurt 5,000 men, it hurts the whole community.
When absentee owners suddenly closed the steel mill last year, a shockwave struck this community. The worst part was there was nothing the people could do about it as individuals. But then they got together. With help from Campaign for Human Development and others, the workers have formed a coalition to try to buy and operate the mill themselves. The result is not only new hope, but unity and determination.
We are working very hard toward it, and there's a couple of big things that have to be done. We feel that it can be done. We know the pieces are there. If we get the right people to put them together, it can be done.
And I think it can be done and will be done.
People together can make a difference. Campaign for Human Development, United States Catholic Conference.
The 37th President of the United States, Honorable Richard M. Nixon.
You'd have thought he was still president. Of course, Nixon did a lot for Hyden, Kentucky. This handsome, modernistic gymnasium, named for him, was built with money from the revenue-sharing program, which passed when he was president. It's the only structure of consequence in town. In his first post-Watergate speech, Nixon launched an implied attack on President Carter, calling him naive in foreign policy and criticizing his human rights rhetoric.
This is a time when we could well, in the field of negotiations, cool the public rhetoric and toughen up the private bargaining.
Nixon had asked that the band play God Bless America as he left the auditorium. But instead, in an ironic, if unintentional, reference to the newspaper that did most to bring him down, it played the Washington Post march, the only allusion of his trip to Watergate. This is Pye Champlin reporting.
The birth of Louise Brown that Tuesday night, July the 25th, at Oldham General Hospital in the north of England was the culmination of 10 years' work for gynecologist Patrick Steptoe and his partner, Dr. Robert Edwards. It took them that long to perfect the technique of removing an egg from a mother's womb, fertilizing it in the laboratory, and then, the hardest part, replacing it in the womb so that it could grow naturally. For Louise's mother, Leslie Brown, it was the answer to a prayer, for without the operation, she was unable to have children, and the success of this birth has given hope to thousands of women like her. It was at first hoped that Louise could be born totally naturally. But because of the risk of complications, it was decided to deliver her by cesarean section just over a week early. Even so, Louise was a 5-pound, 12-ounce bouncing baby, normal in every way except for the manner of her conception and the publicity which surrounded her birth. She was also a very rich little girl, for one London newspaper was reported to have paid around $500,000 for the exclusive story of the events of that night. This is Edwin Smith for Recap 78.
It was 5 minutes after 2 p.m. on November 2nd, 1978, when the Soyuz capsule carrying two Soviet cosmonauts touched down on the steppes of Kazakhstan beneath a billowing red and white parachute. The perfect landing capped the world's longest space flight, 139 days, 14 hours, and 48 minutes. As Vladimir Kovalyanok and Alexander Ivanchenkov stepped from their capsule, they said the smell of the Earth was something they would never forget. They had trouble walking at first and admitted being a bit dizzy, but their rigorous exercise program in space prepared them for a quick transition to Earth's gravity. It also showed that man can work in space for as long as a year. The Soviet Union is moving rapidly towards setting up full-time orbital stations and perhaps even factories in space. The move to commercially practical adventures may not be as dramatic as walking on the moon, but it could be as important as when New World colonists quit looking for gold and started planting tobacco. This is Doug Steinman in Moscow.
November 27th. It was a Monday morning San Franciscans will not soon forget. Shortly before he was to hold a news conference, Mayor George Moscone was shot to death in his office. Moments later, Supervisor Harvey Milk, the leader of San Francisco's homosexual community, was shot and killed down the hall. A former member of the Board of Supervisors, Dan White, surrendered to police and was charged with murder. He had been angered because Moscone had refused to reappoint him after he quit his job, then decided he wanted it back. A shaken acting mayor, Dianne Feinstein, announced the tragedy.
Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Thousands turned out at memorial services. They marched through the streets with candles, lined up to view the caskets in City Hall, filled churches to overflowing, as San Francisco, with more than its share of tragedy, mourned its slain leaders. This is Bob Fuss reporting.
You have been listening to Recap 78. a production of the United Press International Audio Network. This is Michael O'Neill. Thank you for listening.